Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 178. It's Monday, August 29th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, well, let's get the local COVID-19 update out of the way and a few COVID stories. There is plenty of COVID still roiling about locally, statewide, and still plenty nationally. Lucas County average daily number of cases went up over the last couple weeks. I had a greatest hit show last week, so I didn't report on that. Went up to 119 reported cases from 112. Of course, that's a massive underreporting. People say there's 10, 12, 14 times more cases than what's actually reported. And Lucas County and Ohio actually have low levels of testing relative to nationally. Nationally, probably still, probably on the order of a million infections a day. Maybe a hair less, but probably on that order. Testing positivity rates are still high locally, around 17%. Ohio, around 18 or 19%. A little lower in the U.S., 14 or 15%. Of course, all of these are terrible. Trying to get it down under 5% is what they typically try to shoot for. Nursing homes, we had the same number of active COVID cases we had a couple weeks ago, 70 cases, split evenly between residents and staff, 35 each, and we had another death in the long-term care facilities in Lucas County for a total of 315 so far in the pandemic. Hospitalizations and ICU patients in the U.S. seem to have peaked and are heading down. That's good news. They're now at about 32,000 people in the hospital on any given day, and about 5,000 new people admitted. In the Ohio and Lucas County, our ICU and hospitalizations seem to be holding steady. There's been a reversal of fortune in the last few weeks where Ohio was doing better than nationally, but that's reversed, and we're now doing worse than nationally. Okay, well, boosters are coming soon. This from NBC News. FDA plans to authorize bivalent boosters by Labor Day, sources say. The Food and Drug Administration plans to authorize updated versions of Pfizer's and Moderna's COVID boosters around Labor Day, and two people familiar with the discussions. The Biden administration is preparing to distribute the updated booster shots to teenagers and adults as part of its fall booster campaign. Both Pfizer's and Moderna's so-called bivalent vaccines target the BA4 and BA5 Omicron subvariants, in addition to the original coronavirus strain in the single shot. BA5 is responsible for nearly 90% of all new COVID cases in the U.S., according to the CDC. Pfizer is seeking authorization for people 12 and older, while Moderna is seeking authorization for all adults. The plan could change, still, the people said. The federal government hopes that by modifying the vaccines to better match circulating strains, it will improve the shot's effectiveness and perhaps provide longer-lasting immunity. Both Pfizer's and Moderna's applications included data on how well the BA4 and BA5 booster shot performed in animal studies, but studies in humans have yet to be completed. The decision to move forward without complete data from human trials has been a sticking point for some outside scientists, who say the new shots have not demonstrated that they are any better than the existing vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna. Other scientists have praised the unprecedented speed at which Pfizer and Moderna developed the new boosters. BA5 began spreading throughout the U.S. only in early June. Well, I appreciate the skepticism as an outside scientist. I plan on getting a booster. I think we have a lot of reason to believe that the new boosters will be as good, if not better, than the previous vaccines. Okay, and some good news. This is from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. Long COVID, relatively rare in children and teens, study suggests. A study published in JAMA Pediatrics suggests that long COVID is uncommon in children and teens, and that risk factors include severe SARS-CoV-2 infection, younger age, and complex underlying chronic diseases. The CDC defines long COVID as continuous, relapsing, or new symptoms or conditions persisting at least 1 month after the initial infection. A total of 41.9% of COVID positive patients reported at least one systemic or syndromic long COVID sign or symptom or use of an over-the-counter cough and cold medicine, compared with 38.2% among test negative patients. That's a difference of 3.7 percentage points, or a 9.7% higher incidence. So this is what you really need to do in a study, because if you just ask people, what symptoms you have, people are going to have symptoms for other reasons. Like for right now, today I have a sore throat. I tested, I was negative for COVID, but you know, a lot of people don't test, or they don't know, or they just guess, or they just report that symptom on a survey. And so you have to test the baseline of those symptoms that are being tested along with actually documenting COVID positive cases. So the good news is that was pretty low. It looks like only 3.7% of kids, children, and teens developed long COVID symptoms. And that was only about 10% higher than the baseline incidence. So that's not exactly disastrous. Very good news. Though the risk factors for long COVID included a stay in intensive care unit during infection, age younger than 5 years, and complex chronic diseases. Well, one thing that does seem to significant uptick from COVID in kids is diabetes. This from Medical Express. Study finds steep rise in type 2 diabetes among children during COVID-19 pandemic. In a multi-site study of medical records, researchers at Johns Hopkins Children's Center and across the United States say they have documented a steep rise in type 2 diabetes among children during the COVID-19 pandemic. In a report on the findings published in the Journal of Pediatrics, the investigators note it is unclear whether the virus infection itself was the primary factor in the rise, and they point to the switch to virtual learning and shutdown of sports and children and school activities as, quote, environmental factors that likely increased risk. Compared with rates during the previous year, the number of diagnoses among Hispanic youth almost doubled during the first year of the pandemic, and the number of diagnoses among Black youth doubled. Among white youth, the investigators noted a decrease in cases. In addition, during the pre-pandemic years, more patients were diagnosed while outpatients, 57%, than during the pandemic year, when more were diagnosed and treated as inpatients, 57% as inpatients, suggesting greater severity. Overall, the researchers found that 21% of the young people diagnosed presented with, quote, metabolic decompensation, of which the most serious symptoms include vomiting, lethargy, confusion, and rapid breathing. Pre-pandemic, such symptoms occurred in only 9% of children with new-onset type 2 diabetes. Because the study involved a retrospective, that's a look-back, review of medical records, investigators did say there is a potential for inconsistencies in reporting or missing information, though reported on the increase in diabetes both in children and adults, and it seems to be pretty consistent evidence that COVID-19 does increase type 2 diabetes. Next up from MedPage Today, here's an interesting variant of herd immunity with the question, are we approaching herd safety with COVID-19? Despite the emergence of the latest Omicron subvariants, BA2, BA2 1.2.1, BA4, and BA5, Massachusetts observed no significant excess mortality this spring, researchers said. From February to June of this year, when cases from these subvariants were highest, there was 0.1 excess death per 100,000 person weeks in the state, corresponding to 134 excess deaths, reported Jeremy Faust of Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, an editor-in-chief of MedPage Today and colleagues. And this was despite at least 226,000 new cases of COVID-19 during the 18-week stretch, according to a research letter in Lancet Infectious Diseases. The level of excess mortality represented a 97.3% drop compared with the 8-week initial Omicron wave, during which there were 4 excess deaths per 100,000 person weeks, or over 2,200 excess deaths, and a 92% drop compared with the combined 26-week Delta and Delta to Omicron transition periods, during which there were 1.5 excess deaths per 100,000 person weeks, or over 2,600 excess deaths in Massachusetts. We are finally in a phase now where highly immune populations can start to shoulder COVID-19 waves without the guarantee of excess mortality, Faust told MedPage Today. Before, a COVID wave meant we knew we would have excess mortality. However, illness from COVID-19 associated hospitalizations continue to occur. It's not all just about excess death, Faust noted. Rather than the much-discussed herd immunity, the morbidity levels being back to nearly normal shows herd safety, he said. Now, again, this is in Massachusetts with very high vaccination rates. This spring, so many people walking around had a recent immune-generating event, vaccine, booster, or infection, with 80% of the Massachusetts population being fully vaccinated, he added. So now we have at least something to show for that, but we don't know how long it will last. There have been previous drops in mortality since the pandemic began. The first time there were fewer excess deaths in Massachusetts was during February to June 2021, when vaccines were being rolled out. During that time, the mean age of newly infected people dropped precipitously, and prevalence among people older than 60 years was low. Conversely, the drop in mortality from late February to June 2022 did not correlate with infections in younger people. In fact, the mean age of newly infected people was higher, suggesting that in our highly vaccinated state, current levels of immunity are considerable, leaving many, if not most, individuals at high risk with substantial protection against the most severe outcomes of SARS-CoV-2 infection. Fauci explained that other states, including but not limited to Alaska, Arkansas, Arizona, California, Hawaii, New Hampshire, New Mexico, Oregon, Vermont, Washington, and West Virginia, are reporting higher rates of excess mortality during the same time period. Data are currently unpublished as they are incomplete, but the complete numbers won't be lower there, he said. Yeah, we have to note nationally that new vaccinations are at their lowest level since vaccines became available. Now, of course, we'll get a boost in those rates as the boosters come out, but many of the people who have been unvaccinated will continue to be unvaccinated, and of course, those are the people at the highest risk for death and hospitalization, the most severe outcomes. Okay, well, some good news from the Buckeye State. This from the Columbus Dispatch. State report, Ohio infant mortality rate, lowest it has been in past decade. Ohio saw a slight dip in its infant mortality rate in the first year of the COVID-19 pandemic, according to a report by the Ohio Department of Health. According to the report, there were 6.7 infant deaths per 1,000 live births in 2020, down from 6.9 the prior year. Black infants specifically saw a bigger increase in that time frame, from 14.3 deaths to 13.6 per 1,000 births. In total, 864 infants died before their first birthday in 2020. The new infant mortality rate is the lowest it's been in the past decade, said the report, but it's still a far cry from the health department's 2030 goal of 5 or fewer deaths per 1,000 births for every racial group. Black infants died at 2.7 times the rate of white ones. Now, it is good to note that the disparity did not increase and actually slightly decreased, so that's good as far as health outcomes equality. Racial and socioeconomic inequities persist, the report acknowledged. The infant mortality rate not only serves as a key indicator of maternal and infant health, but is also an important measure of the health status of the community. The report raised some alarm with congenital syphilis, a sexually transmitted disease that can infect the fetus. Cases increased from 13 in 2016 to 32 in 2020, which was especially concerning. Ohio requires syphilis testing at the first prenatal visit. Almost 60% of mothers and infant deaths reported Medicaid. Government-paid health insurance for about 3 million low-income or disabled Ohioans as their health coverage. Nearly a third of these mothers did not take advantage of the Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, commonly known as the WIC program, which provides formula, food, and other health services to low-income moms to help fight infant mortality. Ohio's WIC program has seen participation levels drop during the pandemic, partially due to its offline system. The advocates have urged the state to take advantage of federal COVID-19 relief dollars to modernize it. The state health department has said it's working on moving the system online. Hear, hear. Nationally, pregnancy-related deaths rose during the pandemic, according to a report by the CDC. Many expected infant mortality to worsen as well. Ohio remains one of the states with the highest infant mortality rates in the nation. Currently, it's in the top 10, per the CDC. So we're making progress, but have a long ways to go. And surveillance, or monitoring the population, the health of a population, is a core function of public health. We have this good news from the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Ohio Department of Health launches new monkeypox data dashboard, an interactive map showing location of all 147 cases in Ohio. The Ohio Department of Health launched a monkeypox dashboard last Thursday, showing cases statewide and per county, and by age ranges, sex, hospitalizations, deaths, and other information. Currently, there have been 147 current cases across 19 counties. Cuyahoga County, with 69 cases, was the most, followed by Franklin County, which counts 33 cases. Then this drops off precipitously to 6 cases in third place, Yes, Lucas County. And actually, there's quite a few at 5 and 4. So there's a big clustering there, but a big drop-off from those two counties. Just 9 people have been hospitalized in Ohio, and no one has died with monkeypox in Ohio thus far. Okay, well, let's do 4 vaccine infectious disease stories. This from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. Study estimates health and cost savings benefit of childhood vaccines. 2 studies in pediatric estimate the childhood immunization programs have prevented 24 million U.S. cases of vaccine-preventable diseases in 1 year, and their $8.5 billion cost for kids born in 2017 paid for itself more than 7 times over in healthcare savings. They noted reductions of more than 90% in 10 common childhood illnesses after the introduction of vaccines, including diphtheria, flu type B, measles, mumps, pertussis, polio, rotavirus, rubella, tetanus, and varicella. Reductions of influenza, however, were only 17%, and hepatitis A was 87%, while hepatitis B was 86% reduction. By preventing 17 million cases of disease and 31,000 deaths, routine immunizations in this cohort was associated with a savings of almost $64 billion in disease-related costs. The total cost of childhood immunization in that group was $8.5 billion. Again, vaccines prove wonderfully cost-effective. And now that polio's back on the radar, this from MedPage Today, how long has polio been circulating in the U.S.? The fact that poliovirus was detected in New York City wastewater samples as far back as April of this year shouldn't be surprising, as the virus likely has been circulating for longer and more widely than previously believed, several experts said. I think we're going to see over the next weeks more and more reports of poliovirus in wastewater elsewhere, said Vincent Rocaniello, a virologist at Columbia University. Poliovirus probably still circulated in the U.S. after 2000, when officials stopped giving the oral polio vaccine, he said. That version protects against paralysis and provides short-term protection against intestinal infection from poliovirus. The transition to injectable poliovirus, which is equally as effective against paralysis, but not against intestinal infection, meant that the U.S. population was more susceptible to transmitting vaccine-associated poliovirus, he explained. This circulation is likely occasional and sporadic, he said, but the threat to vulnerable populations is still high. Here's the thing. Polio is here in the U.S. It's not gone. It's in the wastewater. It could contaminate you, so if you're not vaccinated, that could be a problem. 10 years ago, I said to the CDC, you should really be looking in the sewage for poliovirus because of this issue where it could come in from overseas and be in our sewage, he said. If someone is unvaccinated, that would be a threat to them. But the CDC never did it. Most areas in the country have high rates of polio vaccination, but there is concern about pockets of rural America where vaccination has dipped in recent years. Most states boast polio vaccination rates over 90%, but in some regions, the percentage may be as low as the mid-30s. And this is particularly important for infants and child care, since polio is spread through fecal contamination. Little kids rolling around in it are more likely. And of course, these low vaccination rates are often in rural areas, so something to watch out for. Okay, well, some better news on the monkeypox front. This from the San Francisco Chronicle. Why San Francisco is cautiously optimistic the monkeypox outbreak is slowing. After about 2 months of rapid spread, San Francisco appears to be turning a corner on monkeypox, the early data showing the local epidemic may be slowing down. The number of new cases reported each week hit a high of 143 the week of July 24th, and has tapered each week since. First 87 cases, then 54, and then last week with fewer than 5, according to figures provided by the San Francisco Department of Public Health. Because data for the past 2 weeks is preliminary, San Francisco health officials are reluctant to say for certain that the outbreak is receding. Still, a downward trajectory would be consistent with a slowdown in new cases reported in the United Kingdom, parts of Canada, and New York City. Cases across California are also edging down, according to the Chronicle Monkeypox Tracker, which uses data from the California Department of Public Health. It is hopeful the way the numbers are shaping up, said San Francisco Health Officer Dr. Susan Phillip. It's certainly better than seeing case numbers double every week. Though officials and experts are cautious about calling the arc of the epidemic, they note that many people in high-risk groups have now been vaccinated, and that some healthcare providers are reporting fewer patients needing hospital-level care. Phillip underscored that she'd like to see a consistent downward trend for at least 3 to 4 consecutive weeks. So far, it's only been 1 week with complete data and 2 additional weeks of preliminary data before she'd feel comfortable calling it a definitive decline. Sometimes we believe a curve is going down and we see it going back up again, she said. We see that with COVID. That's another reason we're cautiously optimistic, but we need to watch closely before we make closer determinations. The concentration of monkeypox DNA detected at sewer sheds in and around San Francisco has been holding steady the past few weeks, which would be consistent with the leveling off of the new cases. In contrast, earlier in the epidemic, there was a clear increase in concentrations in the Southeast San Francisco treatment plant, in particular, which began to plateau in early August, said Alexandria Bohm, a Stanford civil environmental engineering professor who leads the Sewer Coronavirus Alert Network. The network began as a way to detect the presence of SARS-CoV-2 in wastewater and now also tracks influenza A, RSV, and monkeypox. The epidemic is mostly spread through sexual networks of men who have sex with men, especially those with multiple sexual partners. So the community at highest risk is fairly well defined, and there hasn't been significant spillover to the general population outside those networks. Once those highest risk individuals have either been infected or vaccinated, the virus runs out of people to target. Scientists believe that once someone is infected with monkeypox, they likely have long-lasting, if not lifelong, immunity. Once it finds all the people it's going to infect, there's no more people to infect, said University of California San Francisco infectious disease expert Dr. Peter Chin Hong. It's not gone away, but it's finding fewer fresh blood, so to speak. There's also evidence that the highest risk people have implemented behavioral changes, including reducing the number of their sexual partners in light of the outbreak, said Dr. Abrar Karan, an infectious disease physician at Stanford who works at an HIV clinic. Even if the overall downward trend holds true, the virus will likely continue to circulate, especially among higher risk populations like sex workers, homeless people, and groups in jails, prisons, and potentially college campuses, where sexual networks tend to be more active than in the general population. I'm not surprised caseloads have come down. I expect that would happen as we focus resources on high-risk communities, he said. But I don't think this is the end of the outbreak. Okay, and some more good news on infectious disease. This is from Medical Express. RSV prevention finally in reach after 20 years of research. World-first immunizations providing protection against deadly respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, could be just months away thanks to global research efforts spanning multiple decades. The latest research published in The Lancet Infectious Diseases has revealed a long-lasting monoclonal antibody treatment for babies is likely to be accessible in the market within 12 months, following closely by the approval of a maternal vaccine given in pregnancy to provide newborns with protection against the virus. Responsible for more than 100,000 deaths and 3.6 million hospitalizations in children each year, RSV infects the airways and lungs and is a key contributor to the global mortality burden due to life-threatening complications such as bronchiolitis and pneumonia. Okay, well, let's switch gears here a little bit and do three stories on some larger health concerns. This from Medical Express. Despite flexibility, gig work and insecure income prove harmful to U.S. workers, says new study. Insecure income associated with non-traditional employment, known as gig work, has a negative impact on the overall health and well-being of U.S. workers, according to a new article by researchers from University of Texas Health Houston. Gig work includes employment where people are paid by the piece of completed work, by the hour, or by the day, rather than a traditional employer-employee relationship. Uber, Lyft, TaskRabbit, and Handy are examples of gig companies, according to the Congressional Research Service. Insecure income earners reported a 50% increase in poor overall health and psychological distress compared to salary earners. The poor health effects of piecework were somewhat eased on workers when accounting for socioeconomic factors, but the trend of increased health risk remains constant, especially for women, those with less than a college degree, financially poor workers, and non-white-collar workers. So this is consistent with very long-standing and profound effects of like unemployment. So having an insecure income where it's going up and down and it's not reliable, and just the uncertainty of that can be very stressful. Besides the material effects of just not knowing what your income is or having variable amounts of income and not being able to plan in that way. Okay, well, here's an interesting story that relates to the sleeplessness pandemic that we have in this country and probably the world. Medical Express, sleepless and selfish. Lack of sleep makes us less generous. Humans help each other. It's one of the foundations of civilized society. But a new study by scientists at the University of California, Berkeley, revealed that a lack of sleep blunts the fundamental human attribute with real-world consequences. Lack of sleep is known to be associated with an increased risk of cardiovascular disease, depression, diabetes, hypertension, and overall mortality. However, these new discoveries show that a lack of sleep also impairs our basic social conscience, making us withdraw our desire and willingness to help other people. In one portion of the new study, the scientists showed that charitable giving in the week after the beginning of daylight savings time, when residents of most states spring forward and lose 1 hour of their day, dropped by 10%, a decrease not seen in states that do not change their clocks or when the states return to standard time in the fall. The study, led by UC Berkeley research scientists Etty Ben-Simon and Matthew Walker, a UC Berkeley professor of psychology, adds to a growing body of evidence demonstrating that inadequate sleep not only harms the mental and physical well-being of an individual, but also compromises the bonds between individuals and even the altruistic sentiment of an entire nation. Over the past 20 years, we have discovered a very intimate link between our sleep health and our mental health. Indeed, we've not been able to discover a single major psychiatric condition in which sleep is normal, Walker said. But this new work demonstrates that a lack of sleep not only damages the health of an individual, but degrades social interactions between individuals and, furthermore, degrades the very fabric of human society itself. How we operate as a social species, and we are a social species, seems profoundly dependent on how much sleep we are getting. We're starting to see more and more studies, including this one, where the effects of sleep loss don't just stop at the individual, but propagate to those around us, said Ben-Simon. If we're not getting enough sleep, it doesn't just hurt our own well-being, it hurts the well-being of your entire social circle, including strangers. An earlier study by Walker and Simon showed that sleep deprivation forced people to socially withdraw and become more socially isolated. A lack of sleep also increased their feelings of loneliness. Worse still, when those sleep-deprived individuals interacted with other people, they spread their loneliness to those other individuals, almost like a virus, Walker said. Looking at the big picture, we're starting to see that lack of sleep results in a quite asocial and, from a helping perspective, antisocial individual, which has manifold consequences in how we live together as a social species, he said. A lack of sleep makes people less empathetic, less generous, more socially withdrawn, and it's infectious. There is a contagion of loneliness. The realization of the quantity and quality of sleep effects on an entire society caused by an impairment in pro-social behavior may provide insights into our societal state affairs in the present day, Walker added. This finding also offers a novel approach to improving these specific aspects of our society. Promoting sleep rather than shaming people for sleeping enough could very palpably help shape the social bonds we all experience every day. Sleep, it turns out, is an incredible lubricant to pro-social, connected, empathetic, kind, and generous human behavior. In these divisive times, if there was ever a need for a strong pro-social lubricant to enable the very best version of ourselves with society, now seems to be it, said Walker, author of the international bestseller, Why We Sleep. Sleep may be a wonderful ingredient that enables the alacrity of helping between human beings. Sleep is essential for all aspects of our physical, mental, and emotional lives. When sleep is undervalued in society, not only do we get sleep-deprived doctors, nurses, and students, but we also suffer from unkind and less empathetic interactions on a daily basis. In developed countries, more than half of all people report getting insufficient sleep during the work week. It is time as a society to abandon the idea that sleep is unnecessary or a waste of time, and without feeling embarrassed, start getting the sleep that we need. It is the best form of kindness we can offer ourselves, as well as the people around us. Okay, next up, I want to switch to food and hunger issues. This from the Food Politics blog by Marion Nessel. Task Force on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health report. A missed opportunity? And this goes through the report and gives a lot of commentary. The Task Force on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health released its comprehensive report. The report's purpose is to inform the upcoming White House conference on hunger, nutrition, and health. If so, it's going to leave the White House in a quandary. The report has lots of useful information, beautifully presented, and does all it should on addressing hunger. But as I read it, the report, titled Ambitious, Actionable Recommendations to End Hunger, Advance Nutrition, and Improve Health in the United States, is not nearly ambitious enough when it comes to nutrition and health. It makes far too many recommendations, 30. That's always a bad sign. Too many to do. Really, only two recommendations are needed. These should establish or expand federal agriculture, food, and nutrition policies to ensure, 1, adequate, affordable food and nutrition for everyone, and 2, healthy diets for everyone, meaning those that follow dietary guidelines and are largely plant-based, balanced in calories, and low in undesirable fat, sugars, and salt, that is, ultra-processed foods. The hunger recommendations do the job. They call for ensuring benefits sufficient to meet households' basic needs. But the second? A mess. Here is the most obvious example, and her comments follow. Recommendation number 9, reduce the marketing of foods that do not align with the latest dietary guidelines and increase the marketing of foods that align with the latest dietary guidelines to children and populations with disproportionate rates of diet-related chronic conditions. Good, but not through the recommended voluntary methods by industry. That won't work. It requires legislation. But here's recommendation number 25. Increase the ability of food companies to communicate with consumers about the evidence of healthfulness of certain food products and nutrients. Uh-oh. This comes with three action items. One, FDA should expeditiously update its definition of the word healthy. That's good. And incentivize food companies to use the terminology and or associated symbol in their food packaging and marketing. Yikes. And increase the proportion of products on the market that meet the healthy definition. Okay, as long as they're not gaming the system. That's a crapshoot. Two, Congress and or FDA should improve and streamline the process for application, review, approval, and use of health claims and qualified health claims in food packages. New. If it's one thing we don't need, it's more misleading health claims made by industry. Three, Congress and or FDA should create a new process for communicating about foods, nutrients, and other bioactive ingredients that may prevent or treat disease through label claims. No, we do not need more claims for the benefits of ultra-processed food products. What's missing from this report? Anything about ultra-processed foods and their effects on calorie intake and overall health. The term is mentioned once, but only in the context of, quote, more research needed. A clear statement of the benefits of soda taxes in reducing consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages. Why isn't there one? A box explains, task force members voice diverse perspectives on this topic. That, of course, is the industry representatives. A clear statement about making SNAP align with dietary guidelines. This isn't mentioned, but only in the context of pilot research, and therefore contradicts other recommendations. Three and five. Number three, increase nutrition security by promoting dietary patterns that align with the latest dietary guidelines for Americans through federal nutrition programs. And number five, leverage the federal nutrition program's power and economic stimulus to support food systems that promote foods that align with the latest dietary guidelines. Firm calls on Congress to pass legislation to do what is needed. What happened? One member of the committee explained to me that its membership included everyone from anti-hunger advocates to food industry representatives, and too many vested interests were at stake. Members could not agree on anything that would make a real difference to policy. Anything substantive met strong resistance. When it comes to public health policy, which this most definitely is, the food industry has no business being at the table. This was a recommendation of the 2019 Lancet Commission on the Global Syndemic of Obesity, Undernutrition, and Climate Change. Read that report. It explains why including the food industry in policy recommendations that might reduce sales is not a good idea. If I had been a member of this task force, I would have called for a minority report on policies for reducing consumption of sugary drinks and ultra-processed foods. But that, of course, is why I'm no longer appointed to such committees. And I would note that when I did my graduate studies in nutrition back in the 80s, she was already a force to be reckoned with back then, so she's been around decades and knows what she's talking about. Okay, well, switching gears, we got the new results from the annual drug use survey, this from the New York Times. Use of marijuana and psychedelics is soaring among young adults, study finds. Marijuana and hallucinogen use among young adults reached an all-time record last year after having leveled off during the first year of the coronavirus pandemic, according to federal survey data. The findings, part of the government's annual survey of drug use among young Americans, also found that nicotine vaping and excessive alcohol consumption continued to climb in 2021 after a brief pause. Another worrying trend among people ages 19 to 30, mounting consumption of alcoholic beverages suffused with THC, the psychoactive ingredient in cannabis. But there were some bright spots in the survey. Cigarette smoking and opioid abuse among young adults dropped last year, a continuing trend that has heartened public health experts. Taken in its entirety, the report reflects a mixed picture of substance use in the United States that experts say reflects a number of disparate trends affecting young Americans. The devastating mental health effects of the pandemic, the increased availability of legal marijuana, and the emerging therapeutic embrace of psychedelics to treat depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and other psychological problems. Overall, the results are very concerning, said Dr. Nora Volkoff, director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which publishes the annual Monitoring the Future survey. What they tell us is that the problem of substance abuse among young people has gotten worse in this country, and that the pandemic, with all its mental stressors and turmoil, has likely contributed to the rise. The online survey of people aged 19 to 60 was conducted from April to October of 2021. Substance use research experts said the mounting use of marijuana in young adults was especially notable.
The survey found that 43% of the 19 to 30 age group had used cannabis 20 or more times over the previous year, up from 34%. That's a 9% jump in a year. Yikes, that's a lot. In 2011, that figure was 29%. The daily marijuana consumption also jumped significantly to 11% from 6% in 2011. Increase in use also occurred among people ages 35 to 50, according to the survey. Not surprisingly, the surge in marijuana use has been occurring in tandem with the rise in the number of states that have legalized recreational use, 19 in the past decade. Another 13 states allow the medical use of cannabis. Experts say the normalization of marijuana has helped persuade many young people that it is harmless. A similar dynamic, experts say, is also at play with psychedelics. The use of hallucinogens has been stable for decades, but in 2021, 8% of young adults reported using psychedelics, compared with 3% in 2011, a record high since the category was first surveyed in 1988. Over the past few years, researchers say, increasing media coverage and social media chatter about the potential therapeutic value of ketamine, psilocybin, mushrooms, and ecstasy have helped chip away at the long-held taboos that were fostered during the nation's failed war on drugs. It's about availability, but it's also about peer acceptability, said Dr. Kevin Gray, professor of psychiatry and behavioral medicine at the Medical University of South Carolina. Generally speaking, young people don't see these substances as dangerous, but the consequences of using them are still there. Although the risks associated with psychedelics tend to be short-lived, overdoses are rare and most compounds are not addictive, experts stress the importance of using them with professional guidance. Some states have decriminalized psilocybin, but it and other popular psychedelics remain prohibited under federal law, though the Food and Drug Administration is expected to grant approvals for some therapeutic uses in the coming years. With marijuana use, the dangers include the risk of impaired driving, the potential for addiction, and the effects on mental health such as heightened anxiety, depression, and temporary psychosis. Many of those risks have increased alongside the potency of THC levels in cannabis, and more so with vaping products, said Sion Kim Harris, co-director of the Center for Adolescent Substance Abuse Research at Boston Children's Hospital. Some vaping concentrates contain THC levels of 90% or higher, and the increased potency, she said, has contributed to a spike in cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome, a condition that causes recurrent vomiting in heavy marijuana users. Yeah, that doesn't sound like any fun. Overall, Professor Harris said she was encouraged by some of the survey's trends, including the continued declines in tobacco use, especially among teenagers. The drop in smoking, she noted, highlight the benefits of sustained and consistent public health messaging about the perils of tobacco. But she said the rise in drug and alcohol use among college-age individuals was worrisome, especially given the potential to form lifelong habits during these pivotal years. Stress is a real contributor to increased substance use, and it's really been a tough line for millennials and Gen Z, she said. As a society, we tend to be very categorical about these things, she said. We say drugs are bad, that they will fry your brains like an egg, and then we undermine the evidence that they can be harmful, depending on the dose and the person who takes them. By making everything black and white, we lose all credibility. Yeah, so a lot of these drugs, with increase like synthetic and different formulations, part of it is controlling the dose that leads to problem. People don't necessarily know how much they're getting, and that can lead to some problems. That is certainly true with the synthetic fentanyl opioids. Okay, well, the most dangerous substance that we consume is tobacco. This from Stat News. The FDA is at a crossroads for reducing tobacco-related disease and death. The U.S. is at a crossroads for tobacco use, the country's leading cause of preventable death, at nearly 500,000 deaths a year. Since the onset of COVID-19, which has been universally labeled as a pandemic, more Americans have died from tobacco use than from COVID. Although cigarette smoking has steadily declined over the past several decades, thanks to a more educated and health-conscious society, new and existing combustible and non-combustible tobacco products continue to pose public health challenges. In a watershed moment in the battle to better control the ongoing tobacco epidemic, the FDA recently took actions to reduce tobacco use. From eliminating menthol flavoring to capping nicotine levels, the FDA has made a deliberate effort to capitalize on the existing and new authorities granted by Congress. But in the aftermath of the Supreme Court's recent decision in West Virginia versus EPA, in which the court narrowed the regulatory power of executive agencies, the FDA must now tread lightly when taking significant actions not explicitly authorized by Congress, a development that could hamstring the agency's efforts in this arena. Starting in April with a proposal to eliminate menthol from cigarettes and all non-tobacco flavors from cigars, the FDA signaled a redoubled commitment to the cancer moonshot, the White House effort launched in 2016 to reduce deaths from cancer by at least 50% over the following 25 years. The FDA proposal has been a long-awaited step following the passage of the 2009 Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act, which gave the FDA statutory authority to regulate tobacco. The agency's next action was even bolder, as it announced plans to cap nicotine levels in cigarettes and other combustible tobacco products. While not targeting tobacco itself, the FDA pointed to research showing that reducing nicotine to minimally or non-addictive levels can lead to millions fewer people dying from tobacco-related illnesses. For many decades, the oversight of tobacco, a clear public health challenge, has been calibrated by litigation and court decisions. The same will be true moving forward. Following the West Virginia versus EPA decision, these recent efforts will likely face another tier of scrutiny under the Supreme Court's major questions doctrine, which requires Congress to explicitly authorize agency actions with major political or economic significance. Much of the discussion around the court's decision has focused on the impact of the ruling will have on climate policy, but the deeper issue the court addressed was how much authority administrative agencies like the FDA should have. To answer this question, the court looked to a landmark case in 2000 involving none other than the FDA. That case, FDA versus Brown and Williamson Tobacco Corporation, that established that the agency did not have the statutory authority to regulate tobacco products. This meant the FDA had limited authority over cigarettes until the Tobacco Control Act passed 9 years later with overwhelming bipartisan support. Along with concrete steps like banning tobacco sales to minors, limiting promotional activities by tobacco companies, and requiring clear warning labels, the Tobacco Control Act explicitly gives the FDA authority to regulate the manufacture, distribution, and marketing of tobacco products. But the Act gives the FDA authority only over tobacco, leaving it without statutory authority over many types of tobacco-free e-cigarettes, at least until Congress clarified this April that it can regulate products containing nicotine from any source, including synthetic forms not derived from tobacco. What does the West Virginia versus EPA decision mean for the FDA and this cancer moonshot going forward? In the short term, it may slow those efforts. The tobacco industry has already cited the Supreme Court decision in comments to the FDA's proposed rules on issues such as the elimination of all non-tobacco flavors from cigars. This likely portends legal challenges that the FDA is exceeding its delegated authority by taking actions with broad political and economic significance without clear approval from Congress. The practical outcome is that the FDA and Congress will need to remain in lockstep, with the latter frequently clarifying and adding to existing law to ensure the FDA has the levers it needs to fully implement the Tobacco Control Act. Congress must keep building upon the progress it has made to date to provide the FDA with explicit authority to regulate additional products associated with tobacco harm. If curbing tobacco-related harm and death can continue to garner the public support it has over the past quarter century, then there is reason to believe the FDA can continue to positively affect preventable sickness and death in the United States. And if you or somebody you know and care about is trying to quit tobacco products, you can call the Ohio Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. That's 1-800-QUIT-NOW for free resources and counseling. Okay, well, next up we got some good news. This from Stat News. White House directs health science agencies to make federally funded studies free to access. The White House last Thursday directed health and science agencies to make federally funded studies immediately available to the public after publication, a move that open access advocates have long pressed for, but one that threatens to upend the business model of scientific journals. The guidance from the White House's Office of Science and Technology Policy effectively ushers in a sea change in the publishing industry, which currently places many federally funded research papers behind a paywall for 12 months. While President Biden and former President Trump before him had long pledged to open access to federally funded research, the publishing lobby has argued doing so could spell the demise of scientific journals reliant on significant subscription fees to access embargoed papers. "It's a transformational document," said the Center for Open Science director Brian Nosek, a University of Virginia psychologist who helms a progressive open data nonprofit. "This is going to change how it is that science is communicated, and what the public and particularly other researchers have access to in the work that was done." Journal publishers are more wary, with some arguing the shift could promote publishing more, but not necessarily better studies. Scientific organizations argue that the policy shift will primarily hit nonprofit journals and smaller research labs that won't have the funds to put up article processing charges that can total more than $10,000 for more prominent publications. Those processing costs could soar as journals change their revenue models to account for lagging subscriptions, said Michael Stebbins, a former Obama official and geneticist with the Harvard Institute for Quantitative Social Science, who led the Obama effort to boost public access. What you're going to see is a massive drop in revenue for these scientific societies. That is going to crush some of them, some Stebbins. You could wind up creating some inequality within the scientific community in exchange for making the papers much more broadly available. However, Stebbins said he largely supports the initiative, particularly the move to make researchers' data more quickly available in a bid to boost accountability. The challenge, he said, is projecting the federal cost of shifting research journals' revenue model and creating open data infrastructures. So I think that's the key, that last thing. For-profit, this has been one of the most profitable sectors of our economy, has been publishing scientific research. It's because people, if you're a researcher, you really have to access the latest, so you pay these ridiculous fees, whether you're an individual or an institution. But it's going to take a transition here. But if we create open data infrastructures, we can make, because most of the people who review the peer review, when you hear the word peer review, those people are not paid. Those are other researchers who are volunteering for a for-profit publishing company, yet they're not the ones making money. Why don't we just have those people do that in a nonprofit or a volunteer effort? It's going to take a little bit of money, but it should improve transparency a whole lot. Okay, I don't really like reporting on what seems to have any tinge of like celebrity. But this is an interesting story from Kaiser Health News that gets at some supplementation issues. Congressman's wife died after taking herbal remedy marketed for diabetes and weight loss. The wife of a Northern California congressman died late last year after ingesting a plant that is generally considered safe and is used as an herbal remedy for a variety of ailments, including diabetes, obesity, and high cholesterol, Kaiser Health News has learned. McClintock's death underscores the risk of the vast booming market of dietary supplements and herbal remedies, which have grown into a $54 billion industry in the United States, one that both lawmakers and healthcare experts say needs more government scrutiny. Dietary supplements, which include a broad range of vitamins, herbs, and minerals, are regulated by the Food and Drug Administration. However, they are classified as food and don't undergo the rigorous scientific and safety testing the government requires of prescription drugs and over-the-counter medicines. Lawmakers aren't proposing to put supplements into the same category as pharmaceuticals, but some say they are alarmed that neither the FDA nor the industry knows how many dietary supplements are out there, making it almost impossible for the government to oversee them and punish bad actors. The FDA estimates between 40 and 80,000 supplement products are on the market in the U.S. The industry surveys estimate 80% of Americans use them. Legislation by Senator Durbin and Senator Mike Braun would require manufacturers to register with the FDA and provide a public list of ingredients in their products, two provisions that are backed by the Council for Responsible Nutrition, another industry group that represents supplement makers. The dietary supplement provisions were rolled into a larger Senate Health Committee bill that reauthorizes FDA programs, and senators are currently in negotiation with the House of Representatives. The Natural Products Association opposes all of the dietary supplement provisions. Because dietary pills, teas, and other supplements are regulated as food products, manufacturers can't advertise them as treatments or cures for health issues, but they can make claims about how the supplements affect the body. So someone who wants to lose weight or get their diabetes under control might reach for a bottle of white mulberry leaf extract, which killed this congressman's wife, because some supplement makers advertise it as a natural remedy that can lower blood sugar levels and promote weight loss. Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, not only you may not be getting what you think is in it, more importantly, you might be getting things that could be dangerous that you don't even know are in there. It's wild and woolly. Okay, well, now it's time in the show to do the bonus articles, which are a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, all available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. I'll give you the link at the end of the list. And first up, we're going to do a story that's a follow-up to that last story about herbal supplements and dietary supplements. This from my favorite nutrition website, nutritionfacts.org. One, I have 20 this week. First up, supplement regulation and side effects, efforts to suppress the truth. This explains part of the wild and williness of trying to keep up with the free market that costs people a lot. And another nutrition-related one, two, some sugar substitutes affect blood glucose and gut bacteria. So we had a lot of evidence for a long time, which is something to be concerned about, although I'm not entirely sure. I mean, sugar isn't exactly great either. So if you're going to be using a whole bunch of sugar rather than a sugar substitute, it's a little more questionable. Probably best to give them both up. 3, fall COVID-19 boosters and updates. So if you want the skinny on the latest, check that out. 4, wastewater surveillance has become a critical COVID tracking tool, but funding is inconsistent. And this is a problem with surveillance when you get holes punched into it. You get a little bit here, a little bit there. But this actually is pretty cost effective and pretty easy to do and can be used for a lot of things, not just COVID. Article number five, a pandemic push for data sharing could pay off for pregnancy research. This is one of the good unintentional benefits of the COVID-19 pandemic. Because COVID-19 had a big effect on pregnant people and newborns, there was a lot more research that was done and increased a lot of collaboration. And that collaboration could continue and benefit us in many other ways. Maybe hard to believe. You think that pregnancy is such a vulnerable time in the lives of health, but this could be a big boon. And 6, an opinion piece, can the CDC save itself? This is regarding the latest efforts to kind of revamp the CDC. One of the bottom lines of this is that the CDC is important. That's the federal agency that leads prevention efforts. But also, if you don't do anything with the state and local areas and bolster their ability to respond to public health problems, the CDC is going to be hamstrung. Okay, 7, the FDA stands by as the vaping industry flouts its orders. Another problem where the vaping industry is really wild and woolly. And yikes, it's hard to keep up with it. And some are just, even with orders, are just refusing to follow the orders. Bonus article 8. Tattoo ink is under-regulated, scientists say. This is another one where it's hard to know what you're getting when you're getting tattoo ink. Some can be dangerous, and the big thing is it's really hard to determine what exactly is in a tattoo ink, whether it's the consumer getting inked or whether it's the tattoo artist. Number 9, why outlawing ghost guns didn't stop America's largest maker of ghost gun parts. This is another classic story of legal wrangling. So they outlawed ghost guns, but in a lawsuit, the largest manufacturer of ghost gun parts was able to win a ruling that while ghost guns themselves are illegal, ghost gun parts are not. Of course, ghost guns, the whole point is that you buy the parts and put it together yourself. So it basically just gutted the whole ability to control ghost guns. Yikes. 10, a needle exchange project modeled on urban efforts aims to save lives in rural Nevada. So a needle exchange program addressing the health risks and harm reduction among injection drug users. Injection drug use is still a big problem in rural areas, and they're starting to take their cues from urban efforts, which have greatly expanded in recent years. So if you want to find out about that, check it out. Bonus article number 11. Americans are highly vaccinated against polio. Here's why it could still spread. 12. New hope for easing stigma and isolation of hearing loss. This is related to the regulations that are coming out that's going to allow hearing aids to be bought over the counter. And this is going to open up the ability for people both on price and just access, because there's a lot of stigma with hearing loss. People just, for whatever reason, don't want to, they don't like seeing it or being diagnosed with hearing loss or whatever. But it'll be a lot easier if you can just go to over-the-counter places and get fitted or buy a hearing aid. Article 13. In schools, honest talk about racism can reduce discrimination. So, of course, with all the critical race theory hyperbole that the right wing is doing, this is a good example of research that really shows that both the person who's experiencing discrimination and kids in general are confused by living in the soup of a racist society. They need better explanations about what's going on. Otherwise, they tend to reinforce racist beliefs. Article 14. This one is actually a follow-up. I don't do a lot of null hypotheses. I mean, research that doesn't have positive results where something doesn't work. But I really sold a really interesting study that talked about taking blood pressure medication in the evening rather than the morning, increasing blood pressure control. But this is a really good study that actually looks at the outcomes of like heart attacks and deaths. And it's evening dosing of blood pressure medication, not better than morning dosing. So we'll see if that's the last story. But it just goes to show that science, you know, is an evolving product. Okay, Article 15, medical error, an epidemic compounded by gag laws. This, as some of you may know, some people have called medical errors and adverse events from like from drugs or errors in the hospital is like the third leading cause of death. It kills a lot of people, kind of depends how you count it, but it's a major thing. But unfortunately, with our system, our litigious system, what it does is healthcare providers, rather than meeting and non-judgmentally trying to see what went wrong, and from the person who was harmed and their family, more so than money, they just want to know what happened and maybe even just get an apology, is so much more healing than $1 million. At least that's my view. Maybe you feel differently. 16, timely mental health care is a key factor in strike by Kaiser Permanente workers. So they're striking because they're so low staffed that people cannot get mental health care appointments for 2 months or more. And of course, with mental health and substance abuse, you have both crises and you have a key point in time where people are willing to seek care. And if you delay that by weeks or months, you can lose that opportunity. 17, new restrictions for major abortion funder could further limit access unnecessarily. So this is an abortion fund that provides the abortions for over 10% of the abortions delivered nationwide. And they're actually requiring that people take the medication abortions actually within a state that allows you taking those, which of course this has to be taken, you know, 24, 48 hours apart. So you'd have to stay in that state. It makes it really complicated. And actually, it's not necessary. It's not being legally required by laws. It's just a very conservative and scared approach that liberals have in dealing with it. And it shows that, unfortunately, by having one player in the abortion funding game, that one change like that can have a huge effect. Okay, 18. Maternal instinct is a myth that men created. Good piece. 19, is an abortion medically necessary is not a question for ethicists to answer. Spoiler alert, it's clinicians who decide whether it's medically necessary. And last but not least, 20, after Roe, teens are teaching themselves sex ed because the adults won't. Of course, that's a good news, bad news thing. Glad they're taking it on themselves, but they shouldn't have to do it. We can do better. You can view any of these 20 bonus stories or any of the stories I reported in this show by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-